You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 27th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up in the programme.
Today, the Commission has decided to fine Google 2.4 billion euros for breaching EU antitrust rules.
Biggest EC fine ever moves up the rankings of auto-completing phrases whenever you Google Google. Also ahead, another car bombing in Ukraine, another apparent victim of a covert war ranging beyond the front lines in the east. We'll ask who is doing what to whom and why. We'll find out why the apparent final disarmament of FARC is not prompting widespread dancing in the streets of Colombia's cities. And as another cyber attack shuts down systems around the world, we'll ask if this is something we should start getting used to. And later in the show,
2.5 billion people today, you have poor vision and no access to a vision screening, and then something as simple as glasses, which were invented 700 years ago.
The entrepreneur correcting an outrageous neglect of developing countries, along with the vision of their citizens. All that and more coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Ahead of all that, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Brazilian President Michel Temer has been formally charged with accepting bribes. While he is far from the first Brazilian politician to face similar allegations in recent years, he is the first sitting president to be thus accused and can therefore claim to have accomplished something. Mr. Temer has issued the traditional denial. A Supreme Court judge will now decide if the issue should be tried by Brazil's parliament, assuming an as-yet unarrested quorum can be wrangled. German Chancellor Angela Merkel appears to have cleared a path to an overdue recognition of same-sex marriage in the country, saying that she now favoured a conscience vote in the Bundestag. Her Christian Democratic Union party had previously been unkeen on the idea. It may not be coincidental that the CDU's coalition partners, the Social Democrats, are among parties who have said that their cooperation after September's election would be contingent on such a move. The Philippines is to make singing of the country's national anthem at all pertinent occasions not merely compulsory, but compulsorily enthusiastic. An exhaustive new bill detailing proper patriotic behaviour insists that all must stand and salute upon recognising the opening bars of Lupang Hinarang, and provides punishments for the recalcitrant, including fines and the threat of being named and shamed in the popular prints. Among the more charmingly baroque details of the new law, which is in no way a waste of everybody's time, is a stipulation that the anthem must never be played slower than 100 beats per minute, nor faster than 120. And here in the UK, two rival supermarket chains have demonstrated the wrong and the right way to respond to the humorous appropriation of their trademark by a small business. Sainsbury's threatened legal action against a shop in North Tyneside called Singsbury's, named for the family of the proprietor, Mr. Jel Singh Nagara. He responded to Sainsbury's querulousness by removing the offending sign and replacing it with one reading Morrisings, a reference to high street chain Morrison's, and a better pun. A spokesman for Morrison's said Mr. Nagra and his customers obviously have good taste, so we wish him well. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Now, even measured against the fabulous revenues generated by Google, 2.7 billion US dollars is a lot of money, which is why the internet leviathan may yet appeal against the fine of that amount today imposed upon it by the European Commission. The EC charges that Google has used its colossal influence to warp the market in its own favour and has given Google 90 days to mend its non-competitive ways. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Martin Sanbu, editor of the Free Lunch newsletter from the Financial Times. Many questions leap out at me about this, Martin. One of which is, I mean, it is the largest penalty ever that the European Commission has imposed. It must doubtless be one of the largest fines in human history, $2.7 billion. How would they have calculated that? How do you know not to whack them for 2.6 or 2.8 billion?
Well, all is relative, right? It's as you pointed out, it's not that, but it's only a small fraction of Google's annual revenues that are profits, let alone its revenues, which are sort of on the order of maybe 100 billion thereabouts. So It's something that Google can easily pay, but how did they calculate it? The commission says that they've tried to estimate sort of how much Google got by what the commission says was breaking the law, abusing its monopoly power in search. So it's claimed to be a measure of their ill-gotten gains, and that has to be recouped.
So what specifically are Google accused of? What have, in the eyes of the EC, what have they done $2.7 billion worth of wrong of?
So this is a case about comparison shopping. So, you know, when you search for a product on Google, you will get this box at the top that gives you four or five options where you can click through, get to a shopping website, and you'll see different prices and so on. So the commission has said there are two different things that are commingled here. One is general search, searching for websites in a search engine like Google. The other thing is shopping comparison shopping, trying to get different prices from different online retailers. So the commission in Brussels has said, look, these are two different markets. We've established first, we claim, say the commission, that Google has huge market dominance in general search. It's kind of hard to disagree with that. They have more than 90% of the searches in most European countries.
You've got to admire those holdouts still using Ask Jeeves and Yahoo, don't you?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, people have their reasons, I'm sure. But the second part of this decision is that Google uses this illegitimately to dominate another market, which is the market for comparison shopping. So there's a whole history put into the decision by the commission where they say, look, when Google first started doing this 10, 15 years ago, they had sort of a separate website. They had something called Frugal, a shopping website, comparison website in its own right. But then they incorporated that into the general search website, and you could immediately see the effect on other websites that try to do the same service. And this, of course, is something that's paid. Companies, you know, online retailers and advertisers will pay to get into these comparison websites. So the allegation is Google has used its clear dominance in general search to get undue advantage in the market for comparison shopping searches.
Well, which does prompt the question, and I should stress I'm not a sort of card-carrying libertarian crank who reads the works of Ayn Rand.
I thought you were going to say devil's advocate.
Ayn Rand and believes that, you know, devil take the hindmost. But why shouldn't Google do this? It has established its position in the market by providing a service that lots of people like. Why should it not maximize that advantage?
Well, it's clearly in their interest to do that. I mean, it's interesting to listen to what Google says, because they don't immediately deny the premise that you shouldn't use dominance in one market to gain market advantage in another market. They just say, look, there are other, we don't actually have that dominance in comparison search. And they point to Amazon in particular and say, look, people tend to go there to shop. So it's not true that we're the only game in town. But if you sort of step back and think about what the internet does, one sort of analog, if you like, comparison is to say somebody has said this is a bit as if a rail company, a train company, only took you to places where there were shops that they happened to own and didn't let you off the train or off the bus, if you like, in front of other shops. People claim what Google is doing is the internet equivalent of that. And what it gets to is that the internet is this sort of weird space that we're still trying to come to grips with, where one thing can very easily be linked to another thing, which in the physical world isn't so easy. So there's this sort of potential for one market spilling into another market that makes it much more complicated than traditional physical shopping and physical markets.
Is what's going on here that online companies, the power of some online companies, and you think of the absolute colossuses, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Googles, and Amazon as well, I guess. Have they outrun technology? Have they outrun regulation?
Well, I think that's very clearly true. Whether that means that they've done something wrong is a different issue. But they've outrun regulation in at least this sense. Some of these internet companies you talk about, what they really do is providing platforms, right? They kind of provide a springboard where you can get to something else. So Google general search, it's a way into anything on the World Wide Web. Facebook is the way a lot of people today get their access to news. So there's a sort of gatekeeper function that they do. And the danger And in this case, the commission says that it's a reality, is that somebody has a gatekeeper position and uses that unfairly to only direct internet users to their own services and not giving other service providers their fair share.
What's the smart move for Google now? Is it just to suck up this loss and try not to create any more trouble? Because presumably if they carry on down the path they are on, or if they kick back against this, then they might run up against actual regulatory frameworks they really don't like, more stringent antitrust, anti-monopoly laws, etc.
Well, there is obviously a procedure here. They can try to appeal this. It seems to me that the commission has a reasonably strong case, but we'll see. It's up to Google. It's their right to try to appeal. But it's the politics of this that's really interesting. So Brussels, under this competition commissioner, Margrethe Vestager, has actually been pretty forceful in taking on internet giants. You may remember not so long ago the tax case against Apple, which was told to pay tax it was claimed it hadn't paid, that he should have paid to Ireland. Ireland didn't want it, but Brussels said, you have to pay because you've been breaking the rules. 13 billion euros, I think that was. So Brussels is on a bit of a mission here to bring these internet giants to heel. America is sometimes complaining, saying this is protectionist. It's always the US companies that bear the brunt of this. But of course, they're the companies that are dominant. So you need to think about the politics. It may well be that Google thinks, look, they're out to get us. Maybe we shouldn't just fight this particular battle because there might be other battles coming. And Brussels, in fact, has two other cases open against Google for other issues they've complained about. We'll see what they do, but it's much more of a political decision than a sort of narrow judicial decision.
Martin Sanbu from the Financial Times, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily live from Studio One at Midori House in London. It might be coincidence that several people with some association with Russia have died violently in Kiev in recent months. The well-known journalist Pavel Sheremet died in a car bomb last year. Former Russian MP Denis Voronenkov was shot dead in March, as was Yuri Grabovsky, a lawyer representing Russian soldiers captured in Ukraine. The pro-Russian journalist Oles Buznia died similarly in April. This morning in Kiev, a car bomb killed Colonel Maxim Shapovol, reported by local media to be chief of Ukraine's military intelligence special forces and a veteran of the war in Ukraine's east. Well, I'm joined with more on this by the historian Mark Armand. Mark, there has been a run of such attacks. This is the second car bombing in Kiev in a week. A businessman survived one on June 23rd. What do we think is most likely going on here?
Well, the particular case of Colonel Shapovol is probably certainly linked to his operations in the southeast. He was a key figure in the war with the Russian-backed separatists in Donbass. And so one could imagine that there will be people from that part of the conflict who have a strong line in saying that he's been subverting, as it were, their attempts to break away from Ukraine. He's also been frustrating attempts to infiltrate into Ukraine from the rebel areas. So there's a kind of fairly obvious military political cause there. The others are more complicated in the sense that they could all be linked, and there could be a kind of master plan to destabilize Ukraine by picking off people who have, for instance, offended the Russians, or in some cases offended the head of Chechnya, Mr. Kadyrov. Because if we think about it, at the same time as this has been going on in Kiev, in Moscow, the trial of the alleged murderers of Boris Nemtsov, the opposition figure there, who was murdered back in 2015, they're all Chechens. And some of the people who've been accused of carrying out some of the attacks in Kiev in the last 18 months or so are also Chechens. So we have kind of sub-theme where one of the Russian regions is run by a strong man who takes particular offense at people who, in his views, insult him or abuse his dignity. But also there are Chechens who sided with the Ukrainians against the Russian state. So there's also a motive, if you like, an internal civil war, not just between Ukrainians and breakaway Russians in the southeast of Ukraine, but also between Chechens taking different sides in that conflict.
Is a more likely point of comparison the very similar attack on March 31st in Mariupol, a car bomb which killed Colonel Alexander Karaberyush of the State Security Service?
Yes, you see, I think in the particular cases where we see people who have key roles inside the intelligence security services and special forces of Ukraine, there would seem to be a logic that if you're the enemy, the breakaway forces in the southeast, or who others who may sponsor them from further east, then they would make targets, because if you can eliminate key personnel, you disrupt the organization that you're fighting against, but also you demoralize it. And so I think that may be a factor there. And I think to some extent, part of the problem with Ukraine is that there are such a variety of internal problems, including battle for control of turf by quasi-mafia groups, that we should, in a sense, try to separate out these very obvious military intelligence and military security targets from the others, who may be connected, but may, in a sense, muddy the waters.
I mean, a campaign like this would be difficult to sustain for a long period, not least because you would imagine that Ukraine will now institute much more stringent security protocols around its senior officers. But are we looking potentially, do you think, at an extension of the war in the East?
Well, there must be a risk that it will revive. And of course, if you have also potential clashes between Russian backed forces and even Russia and America over Syria, there's a danger that we have a kind of arc of conflict spreading out from the Middle East, leapfrogging over Turkey and the Black Sea into Ukraine, perhaps also neighboring countries like Moldova and Georgia. So there's always a risk that some intelligence officer thinks he's got a very good wheeze to knock out his rival on the other side, but in fact it's going to spark a bigger confrontation. Because clearly this particular case today, for instance, was a very professional one. Although the Ukrainian government is saying it's a terrorist attack, it was clearly a very targeted murder. Murder is a very serious crime. But it was a relatively small bomb, but a bomb that was clearly placed in such a way in the vehicle that the driver and any passengers would have been killed. And so one says it's a highly professional hit.
That would
suggest, you know, a professional organization behind it, including knowing how to penetrate the security of the colonel, which of course is a double blow. A, you've killed a leading figure in the Ukrainian intelligence services, but also you have created the suspicion that somebody in those intelligence services may have facilitated the planting of the bomb, because how would you know when and where he was going to be moving about, which car he was going to be in, and so on.
Just looking finally then at the wider conflict in Ukraine as it is right now in June 2017, do we understand what Russia wants from here, or are we in fact looking at Russia getting what it wanted, i.e. a frozen conflict, semi-frozen conflict, if you will, that they can turn up and turn down at will?
Well, there are two things. A, they're getting, in a sense, as you say, a conflict which is not going to be resolved easily. But also, Ukraine itself is in a fairly parlous state. And, of course, this increasingly puts the onus on the West, on the European Union countries, and to some extent the United States. Will they pony up the money both to provide military resources for Ukraine, which I think is unlikely, but also to keep the Ukrainian economy functioning, because it is in a very poor condition, not least because some of the more radical Ukrainian forces have blockaded trade with the southeast, and that includes important energy resources, because the irony of all this conflict has been that whilst people have been killing each other, trains loaded with raw materials have been crossing the fighting line, or at least crossing areas where the fighting isn't going on, but from east to west and so on. So if you're the Russians, you have, in a sense, you can look at this both if you're in Lugansk and Donetsk or in Moscow and say, we are becoming de facto independent, and we're being increasingly in a situation where we're achieving a situation that we would like. But at the same time, Ukraine itself is constantly a burden on the West, and will the West's patience run out?
Mark Armand, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
This is The Daily on Monocle 24. It is 53 years, give or take, since the Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia first took up arms against the Colombian state. Today, FARC laid them down again, or at least executed a reasonable impression of so doing. As part of the peace deal concluded last year, FARC have handed over all of their personal weapons. 7,132 guns have been registered and packed away, according to the UN. 77 of an estimated 900 arms caches identified and emptied. The big question, as always with such agreements, now what? I'm joined with the answer to that and others by Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's Bogota correspondent. Anastasia, first of all, in the context not just of the peace process, but I guess in recent Colombian history, how significant is today being seen as in Colombia?
This is a major day in Colombia and a really important one. As you said, this is the end of the FARC as an armed group. It's officially the end of their armed struggle, which has been going on for more than five decades. So in terms of Colombian history and Colombia's future, this is an extremely significant day because it signals and marks the end of the FARC as an armed group. And hopefully, from the FARC's point of view, they will become now a political movement and gain political power. So they have given up the armed struggle. At least that's what they said this morning in Colombia.
And has that occasioned much celebration throughout Colombia, or is this now, has this been regarded as a thing that was just going to happen?
Well, it's not mass celebration with people, without tens of thousands of people on the street, as you might expect for such a historic and important occasion. It's worth pointing out that the peace deal is very divisive among Colombians. In fact, it was rejected in a public referendum last year. So, in fact, Colombians voted against this peace accord. People are still very mistrustful of the FARC. They're very skeptical. The FARC is still largely hated among the majority of Colombians. And for a lot of Colombians today, it simply wasn't so much a cause of celebration. However, we did see big screens in the main square in Bogota. People came out with white T-shirts, white flags and white balloons. But it certainly wasn't a massive celebration. And among some circles, particularly obviously the opposition who are against this peace deal, is very subdued, and they've been criticised in the peace deal since day one. So for some Colombians, there's not a lot really to celebrate.
That division you mentioned, the Colombians who are less than delighted by this, what is that? Is it more scepticism that FARC won't keep to their word, that there's a danger of a return to violence, or is it resentment that this generation of FARC at least are going to get away with it?
It's everything you've just mentioned, and also there's another big reason, is that people who mistrust the FARC, they also don't agree with their political motivations and intentions. And for many Colombians, they look to their neighbour Venezuela, and they see what's going on there under a left-wing regime and what many Colombians will call a dictatorship. And there's such fear that the same thing could happen in Colombia if a left-wing political party, like the FARC hopes to become in the future, would take over. So there is fear that if the FARC does win the votes and does become powerful in political terms, they can make Colombia like Venezuela. That's what many Colombians are supposed to fear about. Then there is the scepticism, whether they will keep to their word or not, and also whether, in fact, Colombians will find out the truth about what happened and whether human rights violations committed by the FARC fighters will actually be held to account and people receive justice. So all those things make people skeptical. However, you know, there is to say that there were people, you know, celebrating on the streets. Obviously, people who voted in favor of the peace deal are very happy. It's an important day for many Colombians, but still the country is very divided about what they expect of the FARC and their real intentions.
What do we know about what kind of political party FARC intend to be, if that's where they're going with this? Have they detailed any policy positions? Do we know what they actually want?
So from the FARC commanders I've spoken to in the past few months, they're convinced that they are going to become an important political party. They're convinced that actually Colombians will vote for them, particularly poor, landless Colombians. They would be campaigning on a platform of land reform, on a platform of anti-corruption. They would be saying that the current political elite has been far too corrupt for far too long, and that they will be much more transparent and combat corruption. And also they're going to be helped a lot by what's written in the peace deal, which says that, in fact, the FARC candidates, the ex-FARC candidates, can get 10 seats automatically. So there'll be 5 seats in Congress and 5 seats in the Senate that they will automatically get. So they've got some sort of foundation, a platform from which to gain more political support.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you for joining us. You are listening to The Daily. This is The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, one might assume that there would be no environment more encouraging for small to medium art galleries than New York City, which is very much the kind of place people go when they want to either open a small to medium art gallery or spend more time in them. One would, however, assume incorrectly. There has been a rash of closures indeed, and failures in recent months, including but not limited to On Stella Reyes, Mike Weiss, CRG, Laurel Gitlin, and Lisa Cooley. It is not, however, an exclusively New York phenomenon, and I'm joined with more by Robin Pogrebin from the Culture Desk at the New York Times. Robin, first of all, the galleries that are closing in New York, and there has been quite a lot of them recently, is there a single reason why they're going out of business or closing down or relocating?
The reasons seem to be several-fold. One of them has to do with just high rents in the areas in which they operate. Chelsea in New York City, for example, and certainly areas of London, this is happening as well, and all over the country, really. I mean, in mostly it's the coast in the U.S. and in California as well. But then there is also this shift where a lot of the collectors are doing their buyings at art fairs, and there's proliferation of art fairs around the world and kind of around the calendar. So that provides one-stop shopping for collectors. So they can visit several galleries in one location without having to move physically from one to the other. And many have been opting for that, which means less traffic in the physical spaces where people have sold art in the past. And so there's difficulty in that. And the third reason is sort of Instagram and social media, where there are images available readily now. And people who are interested in buying art don't necessarily need to go see it in order to buy it.
So is it just a case that art galleries, like lots of other, you know, physical retail space, you know, the obvious examples, I guess, being record stores and bookshops, that the art galleries have just been overhauled by technology the same way everything else has?
I think it's partly that. I think it's also that, you know, we keep talking about the art market as incredibly strong and it keeps growing, seeming to grow increasingly that way. But what is strong is the top of the market. So when you go to auctions, for example, you know, we hear a lot about the $110 million sale of a Basquiat painting, for example. But that's a very rarefied kind of segment of the market. The rest of the art market is made up of artists don't sell for that much money, and galleries that don't trade in that level of talent. And so there's really a much more sort of a wider disparity now between those who are selling the brand name trophy pieces and those that are selling everything else. And that gap seems to have widened.
I mean, is
partly because people are feel like it's more of a guarantee to get the names that they know.
I mean, that in itself, though, is it sounds very similar to what has happened in the music business and in the book business. The money that's still available gets sucked up by the big names at the center of it, and there's less available to people on the fringes. Is that a fair characterization, do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. And then the question becomes, you know, what happens to the content ultimately? Is there a shakeout where artists who have not been discovered or who are doing more cutting-edge work and are not sort of tested by the market will just, you know, struggle even more than they already do, and we end up with a kind of homogenized culture? I think that is the concern, where only sort of the big guys prevail. You need all sorts of levels of galleries as well as in the music industry and retail in order to have talent bubble up. from the bottom, and it's difficult in this kind of a marketplace where it's kind of like the cream of the crop is the one that's winning repeatedly.
So these galleries we're talking about, the ones that are closing down in New York City, and as you also mentioned, London, Los Angeles, and other places as well, what are they doing? Are they just giving up, or are they relocating to a place where they don't have to pay as much rent and then expanding their business online? Or has anybody figured out how to make this work while staying where they are?
It's a good question, and I think everyone is kind of trying to figure that out right now. You have different variations on responses. You have some merging and trying to kind of pool their talents and sort of save money with economies of scale in terms of back office operations. You have some moving to less expensive neighborhoods, and you have some just kind of becoming virtual galleries that essentially do their work online but don't have to pay rent on an actual storefront space, which can be quite a drain. I should also mention that a big financial drain is these art fairs, which can cost anywhere from $100,000 to $500,000 for a gallery to attend because there's so much involved logistically. So there are people who are trying to find, some of them are just opting out altogether, but again, I feel like things have shaken out in the past, and maybe this is, you know, a passing trend. We will see.
Robin Pogrebin from the Culture Desk at the New York Times, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to the Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller, assuming that is that you're able to get online. Companies around the world are reporting disruption by a substantial ransomware cyber attack, disrupting systems with the demand of a Bitcoin reward for renewed access. Among the many companies admitting to being affected are the shipping line Maersk, Russian oil producer Rosneft, and the Central Bank of Ukraine, a country which appears especially badly affected. Workers at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant are now monitoring radiation levels manually. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Lauren Cerulis, who covers cybersecurity and related subjects for Politico. Lauren, first of all, the ransomware attack itself. For those of us who've not yet been on the receiving end of one, how does it work? What does it look like when you switch your computer on?
It looks like some strange ghost has taken over control of your computer. That's roughly what it looks like. So basically what you would do is, on a Monday morning, or in this case, a Tuesday morning, you'd arrive at your desk at work, you'd boot your computer, and you'd get a black screen saying your files have been encrypted, which means they're locked behind a system that you can't get access to. And it tells you if you want to retrieve access to your computer and your files, you have to pay a certain amount. And that amount is usually around a couple of hundred euros or pounds, whatever you want to pay in. So it's usually a small amount. It looks like a small amount, which confuses people because then they're tempted to actually pay it. That's what it looks like.
Okay, so this particular attack, it's not the first such thing. There was a fairly major one, the WannaCry attack, quite recently, which especially here in the UK seized up a lot of health trusts, hospitals, etc. How different does this one appear to be to that?
There's a lot of similarities, and I think the WannaCry attack was really sort of a sort of aha moment in which the world woke up to the dangers of ransomware, which is what it's called. So there's a lot of similarities in the type of malware that we're seeing right now. Basically, this new attack, which is called Petya, the researchers are still unclear about the name, but it roughly does the same as what the ransomware called WannaCry did. So it uses a specific vulnerability in Windows operating systems to basically block computers. And so that's the way it spreads as well. So once it gets access to one certain network, it will spread rapidly across that network and then try and look for connections to other networks. This is usually also why we're seeing these attacks spread across industries. So you mentioned WannaCry, that spread quickly across the UK's healthcare system, for instance. In this case, the Petya ransomware seemed to spread in the transport and energy sector at first, and has then sort of gone beyond that.
Without wishing to give listeners any ideas, how difficult is it to pull a stunt like this? What do you actually need in terms of expertise and equipment and resources?
It's complicated software, that's for sure. So in principle, what you're seeing right now is sort of a war between security researchers trying to analyze the code and hackers, with what we call black hat hackers, so hackers who have intents that are not necessarily ethical. So we're seeing a war between these two about how good the code is and then how quickly you can disable it. And what you're seeing is that the code is quite complex, just as it was with WannaCry. It's not easy to actually disable this, or if you're an IT guy at a company, it's not easy to just stop this attack. At the same time, how difficult is it? Well, that's a bit the tricky part with cybersecurity these days, is that if you have a little bit of money and you know where to find software that does these things, then you can easily buy it online. So you don't actually have to be able to code. You can actually just go on what's called the dark web, so fora and websites that have these kinds of malware for sale, and you can buy it for a fairly low price.
Okay, now in this particular instance, the German email provider Postio has blocked access to the account, which appears to be linked to the Bitcoin wallet into which ransoms can be paid. Does that stop an attack like this, or does it just mean that affected people will never see their data again?
It stops the payment system. So at this point, if a computer gets affected and if a listener's computer is affected, they won't be able to pay because the access has been cut off. They'll email this email address, but this email address doesn't work anymore. What it doesn't do is stop the software from spreading. So it doesn't stop the ransomware from spreading across the world. And this is sort of what we're seeing in the past hours. Is a discussion between security researchers who are asking the question, was this ransomware really designed to make money, or was it rather designed to create some kind of chaos? And considering it's so easy to stop the payment process, and considering that the people who started this attack or who created this ransomware only are going to make about a couple of thousand pounds out of it, which is very low, you could kind of wonder, like, what is the intent behind this attack? So in the coming hours, we'll see the malware spread further. But it is advised not to pay. If your computer is blocked, you won't be able to pay because you can't contact the hackers anymore. But the war in stopping this ransomware from spreading continues.
How potentially bad could something like this get if it was, for an example, a state with all the resources that a state would have acting towards a state that it regarded as an enemy? How much potential havoc could they actually cause?
It can cause a lot of havoc, I believe, and I think that's also what we've seen today. If you look at the chaos it created in the Ukraine, not only in government agencies, the Ministry of Interior communicated that their computers were blocked, and the airport gets blocked. Energy companies get sort of thrown into chaos. So what it can do is it can create a lot of confusion, a lot of economic destruction, can create a lot of economic loss as well for the companies that get affected. And in the UK, if you see it targets or it affects a healthcare system, then it can even cost lives. So far, I think what we've seen is attacks that have caused a lot of economic chaos, but not necessarily the sort of massive destruction that we know from other weapons. Think of nuclear weapons being the obvious example. But then again, you never know how bad it gets with cyber weapons. So this is something that other people have been wondering as well, is have we seen the end of this? Have we seen the worst?
Lauren Serralus from Politico, thank you for joining us. Coming up next, our review of the Asian newspapers. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatized am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
The mantis. That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had
today.
A debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
It is time now on The Daily to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by Sam Gill, Executive Editor of ChinaDialogue.net and Associate Fellow at Chatham House. Sam, we start with China, in fact. Now, it's tough to keep up with Donald Trump and his White House, who he's friends with and who he is not. We thought that he was going to be having campaigned on very much not being China's friend. It then turned out he did want to be China's friend, but now, at least according to this story from Axios, he might not after all.
Yeah, it sounds like...
Have I got that right?
I think that's what they're saying in Axios, which has become fairly reliable kind of tip sheet on what is happening within the Trump White House. At least the rumour at the moment is that the sort of afterglow of Xi Jinping's visit to Mar-a-Lago has faded. the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, is currently visiting the White House, and he seems to be very much in favour. Trump hugged him in the Rose Garden, called the US a true friend to India.
It's unusual for Trump, though, being so friendly towards somebody who won an election and everything, though.
This is true. He actually looks rather kind of germphobic in the photo of the hug as well. You can see him kind of.
Is Trump rather than
slightly.
Modi, I assume.
This is Trump. Yeah, Modi was going in for it, but in any case, there's been some kind of unusual tweets, which of course are not. It's not unusual at all from Trump, talking about how that it hasn't worked out. You know, he tried to go to Xi Jinping, tried to get him to get serious with North Korea.
He did tweet that at least I know China tried. He didn't appear to be blaming them.
That's right. Actually, according to Axios, that reflects genuine disappointment. In other words, you know, he really believed that that he was going to just change this actually very complex and uncertain dynamic on the peninsula. Through his best efforts, and he's now given up on that. And now the news seems to be that the US is going to place China high on a list of global worst offenders in human trafficking and forced labor. They also have kind of joined the global calls of understandable deep concern about Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Prize winning prisoner Nobel laureates and prisoner who has been diagnosed with liver cancer. He's being treated in China. The US are joining the call saying he should be free to travel, free to sort of leave custody. And the US is apparently also considering punishing foreign dumping of steel onto US market, which isn't specifically aimed at China, but would hit Beijing very sort of pointedly.
Okay, I want to move along to a story you've brought in from Sixth Tone. This is about, it's China attempting to bring some sort of regulation to bear on the internet, like it hasn't done a fair bit of that already. But it's going to establish a courthouse specifically for online disputes in Huangzhou.
Yeah, that's right. There is clearly a lot of regulation of the Chinese internet, and that's not a new thing. But actually, specifically, kind of legal scrutiny and legal restriction is fairly new. There's a number of kind of new Chinese internet laws coming into effect, and it means an area that was, of course, tightly kind of controlled is now being controlled by the courts. And there's this new internet court being set up in Hangzhou, which is the home of Alibaba, the massive Chinese sort of e-commerce giant. Earlier this year, a court in the city sentenced the man to 5 years and 9 months for running a business that provided fake reviews on Taobao, which is the sort of Alibaba-run eBay equivalent auction site. But the court will also be charged with maintaining internet security, as well as resolving online disputes and so on. So it does seem like a move to extend kind of legal scrutiny over the internet in a way that, at least marks a sort of different form of controlling the internet.
I want to move along now to a story from the South China Morning Post, which, it piqued my curiosity because it's a story confirming that something isn't going to happen, which I, for one, assumed was never going to happen. This was a story that was quite a viral hit a while ago, the idea that China was developing a sort of, as it were, straddling bus that could sort of glide over the top of traffic jams with a slightly wider wheelbase than most cars. And I just assumed it was one of those things that pops up on the internet, was obvious nonsense for obvious enough reasons. But do I infer from this South China Morning Post story that they were actually trying to do it?
Yeah, I had a similar reaction. It's one of those things that sort of came up quite a long time ago, seemed to die off, and then just inexplicably seemed to rise again. And I think actually when it rose again, it was an attempt to kind of revive something that had already been killed off because it was such a bad idea. They quote a transportation professor in the piece who says, it's going to have difficulty navigating turns, and it's going to be a problem for motorists who might drive below it and actually have very limited
and it's obviously mad and would
visibility.
Never work.
Yeah, so it turns out it did get financed in the end by a kind of asset management company who seemed to have set up a peer-to-peer lending platform to lend to it. It all sounds a little bit like a Ponzi scheme, to be honest.
It sounds a very great deal like a Ponzi scheme, to be honest. But it's definitely not happening.
Yeah, so it's now the test site for this beast, which apparently was known as the Transit Elevated Bus, is being demolished. Apparently the bus was sitting there sort of caked in dust, had never really been tested in any case. And now, yeah, the project has finally been kind of put to rest.
But that aspect of it, that it's sitting there caked in dust, that does suggest that an actual three-dimensional prototype was constructed.
It was. If only for the publicity shots in order to attract investment, one might imagine.
Bewildering. Finally, and actually no less bewildering, a not dissimilar story in that it relates to an online hit, and it's also from the South China Morning Post. Explain. Staged brawls going viral online.
Yeah, so the headline is Mixed Martial Arts versus Tai Chi Group Brawl Stopped by Police in Shanghai, but the battle rages online. It's actually a pretty interesting story. There was a fight a few weeks ago between a guy called Xu Xiaodong, who's a sort of quite well-known fighter and promoter of mixed martial arts, and a guy called Wei Lei, who's a sort of Tai Chi master, who had been claiming that he could fight anyone from any kind of style of fighting out there. And Tai Chi, of course, is not normally known as the most aggressive style of fighting.
My money would have been inclined to go towards the mixed martial arts master.
That's right. Well, so but this actually taps into a very deep kind of nationalistic idea about the superiority of kind of Chinese gong fu or kung fu kind of forms. And actually, it's linked to kind of early 20th century forms of nationalism that really drew on that and so on. So it was a kind of it was quite powerful, and then it was an amazing kind of viral hit because the video basically lasts about 10 seconds. The Tai Chi master is immediately knocked out by the MMA fighter.
And, I could have told him that was going to happen.
you might have been able to. Well, now they've gone for they tried to go for a rematch, a kind of group brawl where they were going to pitch four MMA fighters against four Tai Chi experts.
Again, can I bet on the MMA guys?
Well, the unfortunately, the police came in, raided the venue and told them that this shouldn't actually go ahead. And there's now a video going around online of these guys all gathering and the police shutting it down.
Do we get the sense very, very briefly that this is a widespread phenomenon? Is there an awful lot of this going on, sort of hopelessly one-sided punch-ups being staged for the benefit of online viewers?
I don't think so, but certainly this guy Xu Xiaodong has made a sort of career for himself now, streaming online, talking about his abilities as an MMA fighter.
I mean, I could beat up a Tai Chi master. I mean, anyway, Sam Gill, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Finally tonight on The Daily, James Chen is a venture philanthropist and the founder of Clearly, a global initiative to assist the 2.5 billion people who have both poor eyesight and no access to treatment. James is also the co-founder of AdLens, an adjustable focus eyewear technology company, and the founder of Vision for a Nation, a program to provide universal access to eyeglasses that has launched in Rwanda. This week on The Entrepreneurs, the full episode of which airs tomorrow night at 7 p.m. UK time, James sits down with Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli. We hear now how James's career started.
So I was born in Hong Kong, but at the age of 3, moved to Nigeria with my parents. My family's been in business in Africa for almost 60 years now. And so I grew up the first part of my childhood in Nigeria until the age of 10, when I went to a boarding school in Lancashire, into a Jesuit boarding school in Lancashire. And then at the age of 14, my parents emigrated to the U.S., and so I went to a high school in upstate New York and continued at University of Chicago and ultimately spent 15 years studying and working in the U.S. before going back to Hong Kong.
It, quite literally a very international upbringing.
Yes, yes, indeed. But I think it was really a unique opportunity, particularly in those days, you know, to go from essentially then one developing world country to another developing world country. But in between, we got to visit Europe and, you know, so really get all these very interesting contrasts and feel for different types of cultures, right?
So where did you first kind of see the need for, you know, people to help out in the world of vision?
No, I think back now, and growing up in Nigeria, people didn't have eyeglasses, and well, the only the few who had were the expatriate employees or some very high level local employees, and I never really thought that much of it, and I myself didn't have glasses as a child. It's actually only when I was in the U.S. and applying for a driver's license that I realized I needed glasses to see clearly, and it really did make a difference for me. But then didn't really think that much about it until I met this professor who came up with this very innovative technology with adjustable powered lenses, right? And that's when I started to think about this. And actually, you know, to look at the issue in, you know, when I had these glasses, I could immediately understand the potential impact in the developing world, both in Africa from my childhood, reflecting on childhood, as well as in Asia, where I was living at the time.
Yeah, so 2.5 billion people around the world. That's the number out of how many people in the world? 7 billion?
About 7.5 billion, yeah.
A giant chunk of the world lack access to basic eyewear and eye care. And that's something that largely most people don't know. They think that, you know, people have glasses, everybody has glasses, but no, that's not the case.
Yeah. So 4.3 billion people, more than about 60% of the world's population have poor vision, right? The 1.88 billion people who live mostly in the developed world or in capital cities in the developing world have access to a screening and then glasses. But 2.5 billion people today, you know, have poor vision and no access to a vision screening and then something as simple as glasses, which were invented 700 years ago.
So, you know, for instance, right now I'm wearing Warby Parker eyewear. I mean, that's like a much feted startup that is solving something in the world of eyewear. And I bet nobody wearing those glasses right now know that this problem exists, maybe a very small handful. Why, though, if such a huge need is out there and there's startups tackling kind of things in the eyewear world, are they not tackling this giant potential market out there in the developing world?
That's why it's taken me 13 years to try and figure this out. You know, it is. So from a business perspective, it's really the business model, right? The way that the business model works in the developed world is that, you know, you have highly trained professionals to give you the eye test, and then the frames and lens makers, and particularly lens makers, have, you know, every lens is made uniquely to your need in the developed world. It's a very high cost model, and that's why it doesn't translate into the developing world. Now, with the developing world, I think that you can see, you know, what you need to get to is, instead of perfection, which is what is happening in the developed world, you know, perfect vision, what we're aiming for is to say good enough functional vision. And so in that sense, you know, perfection is the enemy of the good enough.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, most people want 20/20 vision, but I suppose it gets increasingly more expensive to try to get to that goal.
Exactly. It's not just 20/20, but there's also things like astigmatisms. And one of the key issues in the developing world is distribution, right? And so moving the massive quantity of lens around to figure out who needs that one doesn't really make sense, right?
Yeah, we'll talk all about this in a second. I mean, but you founded AdLens. So what was the goal of AdLens?
Well, AdLens as I mentioned earlier, Professor Silver had invented this fluid-filled adjustable powered lenses. And so the one pair of glasses that he showed me could correct virtually 90% of a typical population in terms of functional vision, right? I could immediately understand, just from a distribution standpoint, right, that one SKU can cover such a wide range. And having grown up in Africa, I realized that is a very powerful concept, that you just need that one product to cover such a wide range of people. So that was kind of the driver of my interest in starting up AdLens.
That was James Chen, co-founder of AdLens, speaking to Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli. You can hear the whole episode of The Entrepreneurs, indeed, tomorrow at 1900 London time on Monocle 24, anytime you like after that on our website. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan. The researchers were Jolene Goffin and Hansade Achikalan. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.